You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is Whitney with Whale Scout. Today is April 23rd. It's a Wednesday. And speaking of Wednesdays, I've decided to set a schedule for the show. And we'll be posting the shows on the Whale Scout website every Wednesday. So you have that to look forward to. But I will note, it'll be like a TV show where, you know, if it's on Wednesdays, but not every Wednesday, there is a show that's brand new. So, but look forward to Whale Wednesdays for the new Whale Scout podcast. A lot of my friends people on Facebook have been asking, you know, what is Whale Scout? And Whale Scout is a group that I started about a year ago. We are a nonprofit corporation in Washington State. And so we're still growing. We're not at a 501c3 federal status yet, but we are growing. And the main goal of Whale Scout is to have naturalists stationed at parks around Puget Sound when the whales are around so that people, you know, like you and me can go out and go to the beach and watch whales with an expert. And they'll be responsible for sending in sightings to Orca Network and just really being there to talk with people. In this area, when the whales come down in the winter, it can be they can be hard to spot with rain and fog. And it helps to have someone out there who knows what to look for to sort of help people spot the whales. I've been out a number of times on the shore and at a park, and you know, someone just comes and asks, "Hey, what are you looking at?" And you know, "Hey, I'm watching whales," and they had never seen a whale before. So that's a really magical thing. I got the idea from being up in the San Juans and being on whale watching boats and seeing people just have amazing experiences on a whale watching boat, talking with an expert, one of the onboard naturalists. And I thought, you know, wouldn't it be a great thing to bring that level of expertise to the shore and provide that for free and really have that available to people without having to go up to the San Juans or on a whale watching boat. It's also more responsible to whale watch from the land, as we'll talk about a little bit later in the show. And it's free, and you don't have to go to SeaWorld. So keep following us on Facebook. And if you click the notifications button on our Facebook page, then you will get notifications sent to your phone. And so if you're out at Safeway or whatever, and then you get a little ding-a-ling on your phone, maybe there'll be whales near your local park. You can also get these notifications on Twitter. If you're a Twitter person, you just have to click the mobile notifications button. And then again, you'll get notifications sent right to your phone. If you're not a Twitter person or a Facebook person, but you have a cell phone, you can text follow Whale Scout. And Whale Scout is one word, to 40404. And you will get the same text notifications. Standard text message rates do apply, just as in anything else. When you get a text message. So you guys can check those things out get ready to go for the winter. What Whale Scout also does when we aren't whale watching is we like to help the whales out. And we are supporting other local groups that are doing restoration. And we're amassing people who are inspired to help the whales to go out and do what they can, get their hands dirty and clean up their local stream, help with salmon restoration, which help with whales. And speaking of, we are doing our very first Whale Scout Helping Out Day on May 10th. That's a Saturday. And Friends of North Creek Forest, which is a group in Bothell, have offered to host us. And I've been there a few times before helping out on their Saturday restoration events. And what they're doing is they're taking a piece of land, and it's one of the only places left in Bothell that is like an old growth forest that hasn't been developed. And they're restoring parts of it back to to a stronger ecological function. And what it's doing is the forest is helping filter out any toxins and any runoff that would go right into North Creek, which is a salmon-bearing stream. So you can see how we're building the connection here to the whales, and in helping our local forests, we're helping our streams, we're helping our salmon, and now we're helping our whales. So May 10th, you can check out whalescout.org, and we have our event flyer up there. You can also go to our Facebook page, and I have an event page set up, and it would be really helpful if you could go on there, RSVP on the event page, because we're going to have some snacks there, and I want to make sure that there's enough snacks to go around. So we're really looking forward to that, and I hope that you can make it. Last weekend, my husband and I went up to Langley on Whidbey Island for Orca Network's Welcome the Whales Day, and we had an awesome time. It's always fun. You show up there, and they're at the church. They're making costumes. They have all sorts of different supplies for costumes and little dorsal fin hats for kids. My husband and I, we ended up putting a walrus mask on my husband, and then a whale tail, so he was some sort of odd creature. And the other people are dressed up like an eagle. They got people on stilts that are like giant jellyfish. It's so much fun. You can see pictures on the Whale Scout Facebook page, and I think the Langley Whale Center also has a bunch of pictures on their page. You parade through town, and everyone just makes a lot of noise, and then we all gather at the park there in Langley, and there's this woman that's there every year, and she passes out little, like, they're cherry blossoms, and she plays these bowls, and then she gives an offering to the whales, and so everyone throws their cherry blossoms over the seawall, and she goes out, and she's got a wetsuit on, and she gets all the way in the water to deliver her offering to the whales. And she does this every year, and every year I'm still surprised that she's doing it. It was cold and it was raining, and she did not care. She just went out there, and I was talking with someone next to me that says that she's an islander, and her husband go out and they do cold water swims all the time. So good for her. I couldn't do it, but yeah, she's tougher than me, and she had a great time. And then afterwards, we went up to back to the church, and Mike Bursk gave a nice presentation about his work with the Baja gray whales, and he does a lot of work with Dr. Steven Swartz, who we interviewed last week on the show, and it was interesting to kind of see both of their perspectives hear other, you know, some Mike had different stories that Dr. Steve Swartz didn't have, and so he was a great presenter. And then afterwards, the Langley Whale Center hosted a little reception with some wine, and it was fun to catch up with old friends. Upcoming events this week, there is the Naturalist Gear Up in Friday Harbor, Saturday, April 26th, and that's for salmon members, Salish Sea Association of Marine Naturalist members. And it's a great event. They do a gear up and a gear down before and after each whale watching season up in Friday Harbor. The Orca Salmon Recovery Workshop in Seattle, and that's April 29th. That's a Tuesday. It's the day before the Salish Sea Ecosystem Conference. And I'm really glad that they decided to do this, because at the Ecosystem Conference, there's really not a lot of presentations about salmon or orcas or whales in general. And so this is the day before, and it's a collaborative workshop. It's like Puget Sound Partnership, Orca Network, and I think one other group, and I'm getting in trouble for forgetting. But you can look on our Facebook page, and we have a link to that, and then you can buy tickets for that. It's only like $5. I mean, it's really cheap, and it's going to be great through the Whale Museum website. And like I said, the Salish Sea Ecosystem Conference is Wednesday through Friday. I'll be there. It's really more of a professional conference. I almost didn't go because it was so expensive. But then I got late word that you could volunteer and that you could work to get a free booth. And so I'll be bringing up a booth, and I'll be volunteering just to get myself in the door. You might be able to still volunteer if you are interested in going. So today's theme is it's all about orcas or killer whales. That's the same thing. On the show today, we have Dr. Brad Hansen, and he is a researcher with NOAA. And, you know, killer whales are found all over the world. We call them a cosmopolitan species. Up here in the Pacific Northwest, we have three ecotypes of killer whales. We have offshores that very little is known about them. They're believed to eat sharks. They're offshore. We don't see them very often. Transients, and these killer whales are sort of where the name killer comes from. They eat seals, porpoise, you know, they eat marine mammals. So even other large whales like gray whales, they're known to feed upon baby gray whales. And then the third type are the resident killer whales. And these guys eat fish. I call these guys the celebrities. In our area, there are three pods of resident killer whales, J, K, and L. And if you've ever been up to the San Juans and you've gone whale watching, you've probably seen these guys. They eat mainly Chinook salmon, and they were endangered. They're listed as endangered in 2005. You know, this population has a long history with captures. If you've ever seen the movie Blackfish, a lot of the whales that were first taken into aquariums came from this area, came out of the southern resident JKNL pods. Now their current threats are a lack of prey, you know, their salmon stock. So they eat Chinook salmon in this area. Chinook salmon are also endangered. Toxins in the water that are pretty nasty, PCBs, PBDEs. And then their third threat is noise, vessel noise, and the presence of vessels, especially in whale watching areas and areas of heavy boat traffic. And so Dr. Brad Hansen, he utilizes a few different research methods to study these whales. A lot of his research is focused on understanding what the whales are eating and also where they're going in the wintertime. I mentioned a lot that they're up in the San Juans in the summer. They come into Puget Sound in the fall. And then in the winter, there's very little known about, you know, where they go. They're offshore and we don't really have very good data on exactly where they're at. So his research methods are as simple as just following behind whales with a net, waiting for them to catch a salmon and then collecting the fish scales off the water. Whales also leave behind fecal samples that he can collect with a net and tell what they're eating. And more recently, he's been using satellite tags. And these are tags that are attached to a whale's dorsal fin with darts. And you use a crossbow to kind of shoot it at a whale. When he first began this research, it was a little bit controversial. People were a little bit concerned about, you know, using the darts that will penetrate the skin of a whale. And the people were concerned about infections. And so far, it's been going relatively well. You know, these satellite tags are used on a lot of other whales. And so it's a fairly common research method. His first year, he tagged J26. So whales are named, you know, for J-pod, and the individuals are numbered. So J26 is a whale in J-pod. And tagged it originally off, I think, Vashon Island. And then it went out Puget Sound, out the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and then the tag either fell off or something went wrong. And so it was a very limited data set. I was kind of chuckling to myself. You know, they wanted this offshore data, but they have to tag them, usually on inside waters. And then as soon as it, you know, made it out, tag fell off. The next whale was K25. And this was a really unusual tag deployment where the tag stayed on for a crazy long period of time. They're designed to only stay on for like a month or so, and then they're designed to fall off, and then the wound will heal over. But they tagged K25 in late December, and then the tag stayed on all the way until early April. And so they got a ton of data. K25 went like all the way down to Northern California, and then went all the way back and forth, and it was amazing. You can go on the NOAA website and just search for Southern Resident Satellite Tag K25, and they have like videos where you can watch the tracks of where K25 went. It's really cool. And K25 also led researchers when they were out off the Oregon coast. They were tracking the satellite tag pings. They use a satellite that transmits the data when the whale is taking a breath, and so the tag will go in air. And so researchers are able to get data on where the whale is almost in real time. So they went out and they actually found that K-Pod was hanging out with L-Pod. So they tagged an L-Pod whale and got a little bit of data off of L-88. Now this year, they tagged L-87, which is a whale that travels with J-Pod, which is kind of an interesting thing. L-Pod's mother died and it kind of was a bit of a wanderer for a while, and then sort of has set up camp with J-Pod. And this year, you know, J-Pod didn't really go offshore. J-Pod spent a lot of time in the inside waters of the U.S. and Canada. So we'll talk to Brad Hansen about some of his satellite tagging work. His other work uses D tags, and these are tags that use suction cups. So they basically take a long pole and they stick this tag on a whale, and they're designed to only stay on for a few hours and then pop off. And they're really cool. There's tons of data that can be gathered off these tags. They have a hydrophone on the tag that can tell how much sound a whale is receiving on an individual level. So it's mind-boggling, and it helps them study sort of the vessel interactions that are going on in high traffic areas. So this last week or so, we had some just unusual sightings. We've had tons of transient killer whales. Again, the ones that eat mammals. They've been hanging out, a lot of different groups of them. But that's not that surprising for the spring. But what was surprising is that K-Pod, the resident whales, came in to the inside waters. And then, I thought that they were going to go turn left and go up to the San Juans. But instead, they turned right and they went into Puget Sound. And they went all the way into Puget Sound, all the way through the Tacoma Narrows. And I had not seen any resident whales go through the Narrows. And so it was really interesting to me. And I went down there. I was a little bit late trying to find them. But I wanted to get Brad Hansen on the show. He was out there that day with the whales. And his research, I'll tell you a little bit about Dr. Brad Hansen. He joined the Northwest Fishery Science Center in April of 2003. Previously, Brad worked as a wildlife biologist at the National Marine Mammal Lab in Washington. He earned his PhD from the University of Washington, where he worked on the development of improved tagged attachment systems for small cetaceans. He also holds a master's in fisheries from the University of Washington and a BA in zoology. So we're going to get Dr. Brad Hansen on the show, and we'll be right back. We are back on the show with Dr. Brad Hansen. He is a wildlife biologist at the Northwest Fisheries Science Center. How you doing, Brad?
Very good.
Good. Thanks for coming on the show. I'd like to ask you some questions about the killer whale sightings that we've been experiencing in Puget Sound this last week. Sounds like you've had a busy week.
Yeah, no, for this time of year, I was surprised that we were out in the water as much as we've been.
Yeah, so not only last time on the show, we were talking a lot about gray whales, and not only were there gray whales around, but there were both transient killer whales and southern resident killer whales. So early in the week, K-Pod returned to the inland waters, and then they did something sort of interesting. They went into Puget Sound. How unusual is this for residents to come into Puget Sound at this time of year?
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. We typically see, you know, J-Pod come in sometime in the spring into inland waters, but typically it's up in the San Juans. But to have K's do occasionally come in, but this late in the year, you know, April, before they typically return sometime in around June or July, is pretty unusual. And to have them come into the Sound and go very far south in the Sound was very unusual.
Yeah, because they're normally in this area in the fall, and they're looking for specific runs of salmon.
Right. They typically are in here in the months of October, November, December, and sometimes a little bit in early January. And then after that, they head out to the outer coast and spend most of their time out there. What we learned, you know, last year when we tagged K-25 was that those movements are pretty extensive along the U.S. West Coast, clear down to Central California. And they move extensively through that area during that time period.
And I also heard reports that K-Pod, went past Vashon Island and then continued south through the Narrows, mm-hmm. under the Tacoma Narrow Bridge. Is this unusual?
Well, not completely. I mean, they do go into South Sound, I consider south of the Narrows a South Sound. But it's typically in the fall, but they don't do it very often. And so it was very interesting to see that, particularly given that they went down Clovis Passage. Usually you go down the east channel of Puget Sound on the east side of Vashon and then go down into the Narrows and into South Sound. But this was a bit odd for them to go down Clovis Passage.
Yeah, yeah. Clovis Passage is on the west side.
Right,
and then, yeah, then when, you know, a lot of times I like to go out and see them from Point Robinson, which is on the east side. And I see you guys out there looking for, fish scale samples. Did you get any samples this last week?
We got a couple of fecal samples. We didn't see any behavior I take it back. We saw one instance where we thought there might have been some foraging behavior going on. But sometimes it can be a little bit hard to decipher whether it's foraging or socializing going on. But for the most part, the animals appear to be slow travel resting during this period of time.
So do you think that from these fecal samples that you'll be able to tell what they were eating in the sound or maybe why they were here?
Oh, sure. Well, actually, the fecal samples will probably tell us a little bit more about what they're eating before they came into the sound. It takes a while for, the food to wind its way through the intestines. We don't really know exactly what that time looks like, so it's a bit of a guessing game still in terms of, but we suspect that somewhere within, a few hours to maybe 24 or so hours, since they ate that particular meal.
Mm-hmm.
So the fecal samples are giving us a very interesting perspective that's, somewhat different than the scales and tissue samples we collect the actual predation events, because it has a different time frame to it.
So you might be able to know what they're eating a day or so ago offshore.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, we could have an idea of what they're eating just before they came in. Now, of course, we don't really know at this point where they were. Perhaps when we get our acoustic recorders back, and hopefully we will get them back, and hopefully they will function, we might be able to piece together where they were prior to them coming into Puget Sound. We've been able to do that to a certain extent to date, but we did some relocating of our recorders this last year to try to place them in places where the whales tended, at least from the satellite tracks, to spend their time. So we're hoping that we'll increase that sample size.
And since K-Pod came in, do you think that they were sort of looking for, are there any spring runs of salmon that could be available to them?
Well, about 12 years ago when A73 was here in Puget Sound, we were very concerned. This was that orphaned northern resident that had spent quite a bit of time off of Vashon. I mean, she was first observed in late January, and of course, one of our concerns was that she wasn't eating, and part of that was just related to watching her behavior. But after a few weeks, she actually did start catching fish, and we were able to get some samples of what was left behind after she ate fish, in other words, scales and tissues. And based on that, we found out she was eating steelhead. So, there appear to be steelhead in the sound. We would also expect there might be, blackmouth in the sound during that time of year, these resident type Chinook. But the chum salmon that typically southern residents are after, which compose a, fairly sizable portion of their diet in the fall, are all long gone. So,
And could it be any indication that this is like a historic habitat for them, or that there are that some of the possibly restoration events that are going on are improving habitat?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. It this point in terms of, you know, there's just lots of different factors that are probably motivating the movements of the animals. In some ways, it's if food is available and they realize that it's there, you know, they will, you know, utilize it. Looking back historically, the whales used to use Puget Sound more than they do now. It was not uncommon back in the late 70s to see them in the summer, for instance. And all you have to do is go back to the the dates of the captures for the captive display industry, and you'll see that the whales were captured in a variety of different seasons, you know, in Puget Sound. And so, you know, salmon runs in Puget Sound have changed quite a bit over the years, and, you know, some are less numerous than they were, and some are, you know, perhaps the same, and some have been enhanced. But, you know, it's one of these things where to the extent that the whales, you know, are picking up on that, it's hard to say. I mean, we think that one of the reasons that these older females are part of the population is that they, you know, there may serve as a sort of corporate knowledge base. And so, you know, they're understanding keeping that information in terms of where to go and when to go there may be important for them. So, but they've evolved to move rapidly through their range to look for different runs of fish. And, you know, it's one of these things where they, you know, may just be sort of checking things out, you know, even though they haven't been here in a number of years, it's like, well, let's go back and see if there is anything there at this point in time. And, you know, it's hard to say if this is a function of, you know, are they leaving an area that was poor? You know, we don't know. And, I mean, this is one of the major challenges for us, is to try to understand what the motivations are behind their movements. And because, you know, on sort of a gross overall scale, they certainly seem to be tied to, you know, concentrations of salmon. I mean, the whole reason they're in inland waters in the summer is to take advantage of these relatively large runs of fish returning to the Fraser River.
Right. So, yeah, it's a hard to say if they were in Puget Sound because there's a lot of fish here, or if there's just fewer fish elsewhere. And so,
right.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the old adage of, that fishermen say, do you leave fish to find fish? You know? I think the whales go through that same decision process.
And, yeah.
And it's, you know, and it's interesting, of course, in terms of, you know, how do they evaluate their environment? We just have no idea. We don't know how that, you know, these decisions are made in terms of, you know, when they decide to go, you know, one place or another. You know, how is that decision made? Who decides it? You know, sometimes we see behaviors where the whales seem to be sort of trying to make up their minds which way they're going to go. It's fairly interesting to watch. You know, they'll be milling about and whatnot, and I think that finally somebody in the pod says, okay, it's time to go this way.
Yeah. And how did the individuals in K-Pod look physically? Did they look okay?
Yeah, no, everybody was there and they look fine.
Yeah, so no missing whales and no new births, is that correct?
No, nothing along that line.
And so you mentioned some of your research doing satellite tagging. How are those whales doing? How are K-25 and L-87 doing?
Well, we haven't seen L-87. You know, he's been observed since the transmitter stops transmitting back, at the end of January. But again, Jays haven't been in all that much this winter. K-25 looks great, and he still is retaining that dart from the transmitter breakage that occurred last year. But the skin on the dorsal fin looks just fine.
So will the part that's still in there, do you think it will eventually be sort of pushed out and rejected, or do you think it will heal over?
Not sure. I mean, one of those two things will happen. Mm-hmm. It looks like it might be slightly further out than it was, you know, when we saw him last, but we haven't had a chance to look at the images really closely and actually try to do, you know, some measurements.
Okay. And when K-25 was tagged, you went out offshore and did a spring cruise. Is that right?
Well, no, we actually tagged him in Clovis Passage on the 29th of December in 2012.
Mm-hmm. And then later that spring, were you able to go out on a research cruise?
That's correct. Yeah, down on March the 1st, we were able to catch up with the whales down off of Cape Blanco, and we followed them for about 8 days as they made their way up the Oregon and Washington coasts, almost all the way up to Cape Flattery.
And this year, were you given the same opportunity?
We were on the schedule for a cruise, but there were ship mechanical problems that basically precluded us being able to go out this year. So that was a huge disappointment.
Yeah. And is there any update that you can give us on the efforts to designate critical habitat offshore using some of this data?
Well, as you know, there is a petition that's been filed for NIMS to do that. So, you know, we're working on analyses that will, enable us to make an informed decision on that. So it's in process.
Mm-hmm. And does your plan, including tagging other whales this coming fall?
We will again be trying to tag, it won't be in the fall. It will be in that early winter period. We're particularly interested in trying to get a handle on where the whales are spending time in that, 6 month period, essentially from late December up through the, early middle part of June. And because at this point we have a very limited sample size. I mean, we know that, that we had the extensive movements of K-pod, but what we don't know is how representative is that on an annual basis. Do they do the same thing from year to year? And by the same token, the pods may do very different things. What we saw, as far as what jays were doing was very interesting with the movements, throughout the Salish Sea, which I think was, enlightening. We sort of had a hunch that they would spend a fair amount of time, but in this area. But given the weather conditions and the lack of daylight and so on and so forth, there just aren't a lot of sightings. And so to gain that detail, I think, gives everybody a much better appreciation of the extensive use. But what it didn't help us answer much about was what they're doing, how extensive are their movements on the outer coast. And so we'll be interested to, try to deploy tags in J-pod again to see if we can get some additional information on what their outer coast use looks like. And by the same token, we just have very little information on what L-pod does out there.
Would you try to strategically find an L-pod whale, and put more effort to track down that pod?
Yeah, we, as a backup plan this year, are working with Cascadia Research Collective to have them do some small boat surveys off the Washington coast as weather windows allow, which so far hasn't been very successful because the weather hasn't been very cooperative. But they will go out and they will have satellite tags, and if they encounter L-pod or any of the other three, they're basically going to be working in the Westport to the Columbia area initially, because that's an area that, at least this time of the year, K's and L's had typically spent a lot of time. So, if they encounter, and I'm, again, particularly interested in L-pod at this point, trying to get a handle on what they might be doing, because interestingly enough, of course, they were with K-pod last year, but they hadn't been with them when we tagged them, and then they probably split off. And L's also have the tendency to split into separate subgroups. So there's could be a fair amount of variability going on within the whole southern resident community.
Yeah, there's a lot of the dynamics. You get to tag one whale, but it's always the assumption that the rest of the pod is with that one whale, but they could be splitting off, they could be joining other pods, right?
Yeah, but I think that, from what we know about what these guys typically do, K's are pretty cohesive. J's are sort of the same story, although we've had this, A and B groups of J's splitting up, but that seems to be more of a phenomenon that's occurring. From what we can tell, it's, when they do split up, it's in inland waters. They're both here. It's not like one's outside and one's inside. L's, on the other hand, you can have these different subgroups that, show up inside or somewhere else, on the outer coast where it's only part of the pod. So there's a, L's just seem to be doing something potentially quite different.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to these satellite tags, you've also done the D tags, the suction cup tags, up in the San Juans in the summer. Do you plan to do that some more this year?
Yep. we're planning to be back up there this year to do more detagging.
Great. And we are coming up on the 10-year anniversary of the listing of the Southern Residents as endangered. From your perspective, what progress have we made towards recovery in these last 10 years, and what challenges still exist?
Well, we understand we've been able to answer a fair number of the questions that we raised initially. You know, we didn't know a lot about noise levels in the summer range and whatnot. We've gained a lot of information, but we're still working on trying to get additional information on essentially what the whales are receiving and how they might be responding to that. We've also gained a lot of information on their diet over the last 10 years. We have a much better understanding, particularly in the summer, of what's going on. We've learned a bit about the fall, at least what they're doing in Puget Sound. We sort of cracked the door open finally on the outer coast last year with the 21 samples we got out there of scale samples and another approximately similar number of fecal samples. So, by the same token, between our acoustic recorder deployments, some of the sighting network data that came in, and particularly the satellite tagging, we've started to gain a much better understanding of what the whales are doing on the outer coast. You know, that said, we still don't know a lot about what the challenges are the population's facing out there. And frankly, one of our, you know, frustrations at this point is that we don't completely, and we've also gained a lot of information on what the contaminant burdens are in the animals. And because basically there were, you know, three major areas of concern: prey availability, which is, you know, again, we've sort of gotten a better idea of what the whales are foraging on, although, you know, that may change over time, and that's something that we're going to have to monitor. And then, again, we've, you know, gotten a lot of information about vessel interactions and noise, you know, but we're trying to make sure that we are providing proper protections for the animals relative to making sure that there isn't masking going on relative to the noise levels, because Harrow Strait's a very noisy place, relatively speaking, and so we're concerned about the, you know, noise levels masking communication and echolocation signals that the whales put out that would be impairing their foraging. And then, again, we've learned a lot about, you know, the contaminant levels, and we're concerned about the levels of those. But what we're, you know, what we aren't able to fully assess at this point is, you know, why animals that don't necessarily look, you know, in bad condition are just disappearing out of the population. So one of our goals is to focus more emphasis on looking at health assessment, you know, from a number of different angles, essentially trying to use information that we are able to get from the biopsy samples, fecal samples. We're going to embark on collecting breast samples and try to build individual health profiles for the animals to try to understand, you know, what sorts of challenges they might be facing health-wise. Because I think that, you know, one of the things I've learned from the work of my colleagues on the East Coast working on bottlenose dolphins is that, you know, a sizable portion of the population is not necessarily that healthy, and we may be in a situation, you know, similar with Southern Residents, where even though they look okay, you know, there may be processes going on that are causing them to, you know, die out of the population. And so trying to understand, you know, that better, I think, is one of the tasks that's in front of us.
So did you mention you were going to study the breath of the whales?
Yep, we're going to try to work on starting to collect breath samples. It's been done for a number of different other species. We actually did collections on A73. That was sort of how we first were tipped off that something, you know, was quite wrong with her physiology. So we were able, in that case, to look at organics. We probably won't be initially able to do that, but there's been a number of different techniques that have been used to date, and so we're going to, you know, start, you know, down that road, because breath is a really good surrogate for blood. Now, trying to figure out how to draw the comparisons between the two is still a bit of a challenge, but there's ongoing work that is looking at that, and I think that, you know, perhaps with some studies with captive animals, we might be able to, you know, figure out what those comparative levels are.
Wow. So you I mean, what's the process? Do you have to just get close to a whale and like?
Yeah, basically, they're what's been you collect the mist from the breath, and that fine mist you collect it on like a nylon, you know, membrane of some type, and then you basically just can extract the you know the moisture from that breath. Is going to have a number of different, you know, chemicals in it from the, you know, respired air, and then you just can analyze that.
Wow. I've been, you know, downwind from a minke, and that smelled horrible.
Yeah, minkes do smell horrible. And we have been able to even detect in southern residents sometimes that the breath is off, I guess, for
yeah.
The best way to put it. You know, so I'm excited to, you know, try to embark on this because I think that it's going to give us some additional information. I mean, we learned a lot about A73's condition through the breath sample that we got from her, and you know, and it let us down, you know, a progressive path toward understanding what we needed to do relative to, you know, her rehabilitation.
Wow, that is fascinating. If there was like one thing that you could tell the public or ask them to do that would make a difference for Southern residents, what would it be?
Well, I think that the main thing that the public needs to understand is that, you know, I think we're one of our main concerns is about prey availability. And one thing I want to I've been trying to convey is that based on the data we've collected on the whales' feeding habits for the last several years is that, you know, they feed from a variety of different, you know, basins. They appear to be dependent on salmon up and down the west coast of the U.S. as well as up into Canada. And, you know, getting, providing new an abundance of fish for these whales is going to depend on habitat protection and restoration in a number of different areas. And so it's not I think that the efforts in Puget Sound are great. I would hope that we continue to do that, do better in the future. But we can't forget about other places because if you particularly look at the scales that we collect on the outer coast, they come from all the way from California to Puget Sound. And so all of these areas are important to the whales. And I think that that's is reflected in the analyses that were done a few years ago by John Ford and Eric Ward at our lab, where they looked at the relationship between salmon abundance back in the 90s when the population went through this 20% decline, and as well, and found that the best association for this was when they included all salmon populations coastwide.
Wow. So it's not just, right, the, you know, Fraser River salmon or the Puget Sound salmon. It's salmon from almost Canada all the way down to California.
Yeah, it's everywhere. And part of the, I think, challenge here is that, you know, the whales have adapted to or evolved essentially to be highly mobile. And so because historically you were going to have salmon variability and salmon abundances. And so the whales are going to move to different places based on what, you know, what runs are strong. My concern is that you have the situation where, you know, the at least for K's and L's, they spend a lot of time on the outer coast. They, based on the DDT and PCB ratios, we know that they have to be eating a fair amount of Chinook from Central Valley, just based on where those fish are spending time. You just couldn't have DDT levels in the tissues of the whales without eating a fair number of those fish. But the challenge is if that those runs aren't particularly good, and the spring run on the Columbia isn't good, the Fraser spring runs have not been particularly good for a number of years. If you have sort of have these serial failures, then what do the whales do? And that's the challenge in front of us, is trying to figure out how, you know, we try to maintain these runs so that at least, because the whales are not, killer whales are not like these large baleen whales where they can't essentially stockpile blubber for, you know, multiple month periods. The whales are probably on about a 6 week, you know, have a sort of a 6 week metabolic window where they can go without a lot of food, but after that, then, you know, they're going to get into a very compromised, you know, health status.
Wow. It's so important for all of us to do what we can to help the recovery of southern resident killer whales. And thank you so much for being on the show today. And good luck with all of your research. And I hope that you stay busy. And yeah, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. We are back here on the show. I want to thank you all for listening today. We will be back next Whale Wednesday with another Whale Scout podcast. And in the meantime, check out whalescout.org, our Facebook page, and Twitter at Whale Scout. And don't forget, Whale Scout helping out May 10th at North Creek Forest. Check that event page out, RSVP. We want to be sure we have enough food for everyone. And do your part, help make a new park, and help the whales while you're at it. So thanks again, everybody. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. Bye.